And now on today's speakers. Today we're privileged to have, we've got two speakers for today's presentation. First is Randy Chapman from Petroleum. He's a Petroleum Remediation Program Leader in the Northern Regional Office of the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality. He's a graduate of Clemson University, and he began his career with petroleum investigations and cleanups in 1990 in the state of South Carolina with their Department of Health and Environmental Control. In 93, he was hired with the Northern Regional Office of Virginia DEQ, and since that time, that office has approximately 6,700 confirmed petroleum releases that have been reported to that office. The office utilizes a risk-based approach, and these investigations and cleanups may be incorporated into a brownfield redevelopment strategy when it's appropriate. Currently, Randy is a case manager for over 100 open cases. Our second speaker is Daniel Emig. He's a civil engineer with the Office of Environmental Quality with the City of Alexandria, Virginia. During Dan's 12-year career, he's worked for the public and private sector on a wide range of civil engineering, land planning, environmental remediation projects, primarily in Washington, D.C., Boston, and at the Atlanta areas. He's got a bachelor of science degree in civil engineering from Valparaiso University. So today, what we're going to talk about is the redevelopment of a former petroleum bulk terminal in Alexandria, Virginia, into a residential reuse. Site operated as a fuel depot since the late 1800s, and environmental work began in the early 1980s. Excuse me. In the early 2000s, the triad philosophy was adopted, and systematic planning, including stakeholder and community involvement, including how the adjacent property owner played a role in assisting remediation, and how a conceptual site model was used to make decisions on the site, including the potential for underground city infrastructure to act as a conduit. And since that time, the property has been developed, redeveloped into 18 townhomes and 40 condo units with a below-grade parking structure. So that's a very quick overview of our presentation. And now I'm going to turn things over to Randy, which should put us on slide three.
Thank you. This particular site has a long history with our office. We first had a pollution complaint assigned to it back in 1980, as Mike just indicated. But this one has a lot of things and a lot of involvement, and some of these may apply to some of you, some of it may not. Some of it is pretty unique to Virginia in the way that we run our program and the funding mechanism and the technical aspects of it. And I'm just going to go through the history, and obviously if you have any questions at the end, I'll be glad to answer them. Basically, in Virginia, we have a brownfields program also. It's in just kind of to set the basic things here. Brownfields, obviously, revitalization of the sites. We want to enhance the public and private partnerships. We want to identify those sites that could be used for redevelopment, and we want to be able to identify those misconceptions that often are associated with brownfields, and what type of property it can be and what the future use is. And we want to be able to work with overcoming these problems, and I personally think that we probably did that on this one. In Virginia, we do have our own, as I indicated, our own brownfields program. This is now on slide five. I'm just going to be going through some of this stuff here as I go through the slides. A lot of these first ones are going to be quick. We have a non-enforcement process that we use. It's an enticement. That's the way it is. We try to work with developers and property owners to get them to redevelop these sites and work with them the best way we can and offer incentives when it's appropriate. Slide six is that we have a voluntary remediation program, basically as it sounds. If you come in and do voluntary work on it, we can offer certain things to you. We can offer limited liability. We can offer certain letters, limited liability letters from the director of our agency. We have an amnesty program if you report findings during the redevelopment. So there's an incentive to be able to, to redevelop the property and not be gigged, so to speak. Slide seven is, again, continuation. We have the voluntary environmental assessment immunity. We have civil charge mitigations. We offer what is called comfort letters, basically that we can offer to banks, to prospective purchasers, to current owners, that basically says, listen, if you do this, then the DEQ will, you know, try to work with you on it. We won't find you liable for these things. And we have found that those comfort letters have really been useful for us because they kind of lay out, you know, what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. Also, for slide 8, we do have some low-interest loans and that we could be used for brownfields cleanup. Right now, we have a new governor in our state. Our budget situation, I'm sure, is like a lot of your other states where money's pretty tight. Not quite sure what the status is going to be for those brownfield grants, but up until now, we have had some limited access to those things. There's a contact name there, a number, if you have any particular questions about our brownfields program in Virginia. Next slide, 9. Here's just basically the law, again, about the brownfields. But for this particular site, one of the things that was made it really workable is that in Virginia, we have Virginia Petroleum Storage Tank Fund. Basically, any owner or operator of an underground or above-ground petroleum storage tank has access to this cleanup fund. And this cleanup fund can be used for assessments, remediation, corrective actions. And for this particular site, because it was a bulk storage terminal for petroleum, we're able to use this fund in addition to those brownfields incentives to kind of say, listen, this is what we want to, you know, we need to do something, and here's some things that we can offer to other parties to help get this thing jump-started. Now, a little basic about the site. It's in the inside of the Beltway. It's out of the District of Columbia. It's in Alexandria, which is a town that was surveyed by George Washington when he was a teenager back in the 1700s, 1748 specifically. This particular facility has been around as some sort of fuel storage. This is slide 11. Since the late 1800s, coal primarily at the beginning, and other types of fuels. But in 1962, the bulk storage terminal was built on the property. It was basically most of it was a UST bulk storage terminal. There was over a 500,000 gallons of storage capacity of underground storage tanks on this particular block on Duke Street in Alexandria. There were some ASTs. There was also the rail line that came through the back of the property that supplied the fuel for the above-ground tanks and the underground storage tanks. In 1980 is when we had the first what we would call a pollution complaint for our site, and I'm going to go on to slide 12. Just a little background also about the area, the neighborhood. As I said, this is Alexandria. It's not the downtown historic section, but it's right on the edge of the historic section. They have a lot of old buildings. The historic issues did come up during the redevelopment, but up until the early 2000s, the street had pretty much looked the way it had for a long time, and there were things that we had to consider, local residents, local business owners, and obviously when we wanted to redevelop it, Alexandria specifically wanted to make it look much like the city of Alexandria looks today. All right, to begin with, back in 1982, this is slide 13, the city was doing some utility work a couple blocks down on Duke Street, and as it was reported to us, they thought that they had hit an underground oil pipeline because there was so much oil that was discovered in this excavation for this utility line. And back in that day, we did not have the DEQ, we had the State Water Control Board. So we rolled out to the site, and at that time, it's funny, just as a side note, I don't know if you guys have a lot of old handwritten notes, but in our files we have all these, you know, pre-PC notes where people would say what they really thought, and this particular one, the owners kind of thought really they wanted us off the site and to stop bothering them. But at that time we found over 40 inches of product in this excavation, and over the next couple of years, working with the State Water Control Board, and this is now on slide 14, we recovered. You know, by September of 84, we had already pulled out of the ground 26,000 gallons of free product from the area around the Fannin bulk storage terminal. And at that time, it was pretty obvious that the only place that could have supplied that much fuel had to be the bulk storage terminal. By 85, we had over 27,000. At that time, according to the records, that facility was pumping, it was selling between 15 and 18 million gallons of fuel per year, so there certainly was a large source area, a potential source area for all of this product. Now, next slide, 15. The initial assessment. Back in those days, again, like a lot of other states, we really didn't have any regulations or really didn't have a lot of oomph with our program, but we did, you know, have them do free product recovery. So they installed a bunch of recovery wells. They drilled all over their portion of the property and found quite a bit of fuel. As you can see from that photo there, there was the railroad line that ran across the back of the property. There's also the above-ground storage tanks with the name of the terminal on the one of those photos that says Fannin. And they basically determined that there was pretty much product all over the site. On slide 16, you'll see a map from the early 80s of the property and the rail lines. And down in the right-hand corner, you'll see the free product conveniently isolated to the property and not migrating off-site, which obviously was not the case. Slide 17, as we did a better definition of the product plume in the 90s, you can see that we did determine that it had moved off-site, and obviously that went with the evidence from the early 80s. Now, of course, we were limited. We were limited by off-site access. We were limited to, you know, access to the Duke Street, which is a very busy road in Alexandria. And we're also just limited by what we could do under the regulations and under the law and working with an active bulk storage terminal. Next slide, slide 18. Okay, when I took over the case in the early 2000s, I looked at it and I realized that this is not going to work, what we're doing. All we're really doing is just pulling product out of the ground, and we weren't really making any headway. So we needed to do some sort of, you know, we needed to basically a paradigm shift on this particular site. We needed to figure out what we were going to do long term. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the site was undergoing change. The railroad line had been removed, new condominiums behind it, the terminal had been built, and the site was getting, you know, the whole area was kind of changing. A lot more properties were being redeveloped, condos, townhomes, things like that. And I figured that that was kind of a maybe the beginning of, you know, the end for this terminal if we could get this thing out of here and really do some cleanup. So slide 19, what we did was we identified what the needs were for this particular site. And obviously we needed to define the extent, the true extent and severity of how bad this problem was. As I mentioned, we are a risk-based program in Virginia. We don't clean up to a particular standard. We clean up based upon the risk. So there are a lot of sites, if it's a lower risk, where we leave contamination behind. Obviously, in this site, we need to remove the product, but any of the residual or dissolve phase that was not presenting a risk could probably be left behind. Now, in order to do that, we had to know where it was. So we needed to identify all the areas where the contamination was. We needed to identify what we needed to take out and address, and we needed to identify what we could leave behind based upon an acceptable risk scenario. And obviously, because this thing had such a long history and there were so many parties involved, we needed a lot of players involved. We needed a lot of consensus from the local officials, the city, the neighbors, the property owners, developers, and things like that. So, slide 20. This is the first time I ever did a big project with the MIP survey, and I don't know if any of you have ever used it, but I'm certainly a proponent of it. I think it was a great tool. And what we did was we decided to use a MIP survey for the property. And from the Triad Resource Center, I got a lot of great information on how to do this kind of triad approach, because I had never done a project like this before where so many players were involved. So using that resource, basically in that philosophy, coupled with the redevelopment, you know, goal for this particular project, that's kind of what we were looking at. Slide 21. Okay. First of all, just kind of maybe slides somewhat out of order here, but MIP survey, again, if you've never used it, basically a subsurface 3D picture of what you have. Since we were looking for petroleum here, it was a lot easier for us. We use Columbia technology. The triad approach, slide 22, basically identifying all the players that we needed to be involved, and that was obviously the Fannin Petroleum, the responsible person, as we call them, the city of Alexandria, the developer. And in that case, in the early 2000s, we started talking to Fannin about what they wanted to do long-term, and Van Meter Homes was interested in purchasing the property, and that's when we first started sitting down with them and talking to them about what this could be and what we could do and not do. And again, that whole triad philosophy of getting all the players involved, local citizens, the neighbors, the churches, the city, and all these things. A lot of people were at the table this, in the early days. Again, for the redevelopment, kind of looking at the idea of what we could do, slide 23, there were some obviously ground rules that we had to set. You know, if we were going to go into the groundwater with a below-grade structure or have a structure above the groundwater, and the pros and cons of it. In the end, the structure was built above groundwater, which made things a lot more viable and you know, presented a better model for us. Slide 24, again, redevelopment. One of the things I had to do was, because this was going to be such a big investment in time and monies out of our cleanup fund, I had to get consensus from my central office about the value of doing such a big cleanup. And one of the things that we looked at was the potential economic value to the city of Alexandria and to the area, not only of removing a bulk storage terminal, but of what would the value be. And at that time, it was estimated that the value of the property, once it was redeveloped, would be about $45 million, which obviously, you know, is a big, big tax base there. And it was something that our central office was able to, you know, see a really good benefit of doing. Okay, obviously, the next slide, 25, there was a lot of initial work that we had to do. We had to define and recreate the corrective action plan. So working with the consultant for the responsible person, we developed a new corrective action plan that would identify what we wanted to do at the site, the MIP survey, to and basically it was kind of a continuing corrective action plan where we would first identify the extent and severity and then kind of determine what we needed to do with each, you know, those areas of contamination, working with the developer for the on-site work and the off-site work. Now, next, 26, the process. Again, this took a lot of work. We had to talk to the city about road closures, to do this rolling membrane interface probe survey along Duke Street, which is, again, as I mentioned, a very busy street. We had the side streets we had to look at. We had all of the utility lines we had to look at. We had to take everything into account, all the past, you know, create the conceptual site model, develop what we wanted to do, how we were going to do it, get all the players to buy in on what we were going to do, agree about real-time decisions, about being able to make the decisions in the field, and, you know, to be able to define what the, you know, what this problem was and how we could solve it. Slide 27, again, part of the MIP survey, and closing, you know, we had to get training for the road closures for the crews because of the VDOT requirements, our Department of Transportation. That one picture there of the, in the bottom right-hand corner on slide 27, the lines across that intersection, those are just some of the utility lines that were going underneath that part of the intersection right in front of the Fannin Terminal. Again, things that we had to consider getting, you know, the telephone company, the water company, the city, and all those other people involved about what we were doing. Slide 28, the MIP survey, again, just some pictures from the field of what we were doing on a very cold January 2006, I think 3 weeks that we were out there doing it. Slide 29, the results, again, of the field laboratory in the trailer there, in the truck, being able to make the real-time decisions and starting off, you know, with the grid pattern, and as we move down the main street and the side streets, being able to adjust how far apart these points would be, how deep we would go to kind of get a better 3D picture of the extent and severity of the problem. Slide 30. Here's the results. It's basically a map of the utilities and the MIP points that we had along Duke Street. Duke Street is the main road that runs from left to right at the top of the picture there, and some of the side streets. The Fannin Terminal is kind of to the right of the center of that picture there, of that drawing. You can see the outline of the underground storage tanks on that property, and basically all those white dots are where we did the MIP survey points. Okay, now the results I've just thrown in here, obviously we had a lot of data from the site, but this particular next one, slide 31, is the results, the PID results. basically showing the aerial view of the plume layout. And this was a bit of a, this one really kind of surprised us. The main plume in the center there, the dark plume, we knew about because of all the assessment work we had done on the property. The plume over to the right-hand side up towards the Duke Street, that was a bit of a surprise to us because we hadn't realized that there was that component present. And there's also the portion that came from the adjacent property to the right-hand side of that picture. Now, the next slide, 32, is kind of a cross-section, a side view of what that looks like. Now, the area, green area there is the area of contamination, and that happens to coincide where it spreads out along the water table, which also coincides to the depth of the utility lines. And as you can see there, it's conveniently right at the utility corridor. And that then started making a lot of sense for us about maybe why we were seeing it down the street so far in I-82, and also some other things that we had run into with the city of Alexandria in the early 2000s when they were doing some repair work along the utility lines on Duke Street. We kept finding petroleum contamination along some of the old utility lines. So slide 33, next one down, is again a close-up view of that main section of where the utility lines are and the area of contamination. Okay, 34, back up to the aerial view of it. I just wanted to, again, look at the cross streets there, the Duke Street on the top and the cross streets, and you can see where those plume areas intersect those cross streets as well as the Duke Street. And at this time, we were really beginning to really solidify that that was our conveyance. The reason that it had not migrated as much off the property is we felt that a lot of that contamination, the product, the petroleum, had just intersected the utility corridors and used that as a preferential pathway, which then we felt was good because if we redeveloped that property and obviously removed the source and removed much of the saturated soils, that that at some point would no longer be an issue because whatever would be migrating would be pretty minimal. And just to verify that we didn't have an off-site component, the next slide, 35, is looking from the, basically from the other side of Duke Street, from that top side of Duke Street back towards the terminal. We did some MIF surveys along that edge of the Duke Street, and we didn't see any migration of petroleum contamination across Duke Street, across that utility corridor. Again, you know, supporting the belief that it had used the utility lines as a pathway. Slide 36, okay. So when we went back, and part of the whole thing with Triad is collaborative data, and I don't know if I'm really misusing this term here, but what we did was we looked at the data from the MIF survey as well as the historic data, and we, you know, it basically jived. It, where we thought we were going to find contamination, we found contamination. Where we didn't find contamination, down gradient, we didn't find it. But it went with why we had so much contamination along the utility line. It kind of made a big sense. And where we, the hot spots were is where we found the hottest points during the MIF survey. So we felt really good that this, everything working together was making sense. And that allowed us to sit down with a lot of the local officials, the property owners, particularly the offsite property owners, that we had a really good picture of how bad this was and how, you know, where it was and where it wasn't, and that, again, working with the developer, when Van Meter would come in and as part of their process, they kind of had a, they knew what they were going to run into. Now, 37, this information, we took this information, and we obviously, they were able to adjust their plans with regard to the redevelopment. They knew, they determined that they didn't want to go as deep down into the water table, so they kept everything above the water table. We worked with the developer on what we would reimburse for with regard to soil excavation, what we would not reimburse for. One thing that needs to be clear here is our fund isn't used just to redevelop a property. And the fact that some of that contaminated soil may be contaminated with petroleum doesn't necessarily mean it's a risk issue. Just because it exceeds a 50 part per million doesn't mean that we would have asked to have it removed. But since they were going to dig out corner to corner on that property, that entire 1300 block, they were going to get rid of it anyway. So we had to work out what the fund would cover and what it wouldn't cover. dewatering and a lot of issues. There's a lot of negotiations, a lot of back and forth, and obviously the RP, the responsible party, Phantom Petroleum, and the consultant was involved. We updated the corrective action plan to include a passive vent system below the garage structure, vapor barrier, which the city will discuss a little bit later as part of their requirements of upgrading. They asked for some upgrades. But again, sitting down with all the parties and working through the process. Now, this was, again, in the early January 2006, mid-2006, we were going to do this, and it was supposed to start construction. And then slide 38, the economy changed. So everything kind of ground to a halt. Obviously, this was a big investment for this developer to do this, and things kind of stopped, and we kind of were at a standstill. So basically, for all of 2006, nothing happened. Slide 39, finally, in the summer of 2007, at least the responsible person, Phantom Petroleum, they started moving forward on the tank excavation. So they went through and they removed all of the underground storage tanks. We had, you know, 30,000 gallon underground storage tanks at that property. Some of them were in use, some of them were out of use. During that time, we just removed the tanks. We relocated the remediation system that was on the Phantom property to the adjacent property where the offsite plume was located. We found the old delivery lines from the ASTs to the USTs. Even the Alexandra historic folks, the historians were down there because we were right on the edge of the historic zone for Alexandra, and they were involved with some of the excavations to make sure that we didn't uncover anything. So late 2007, 2008, the redevelopment finally started with the excavation, the shoring and sheeting of the pit, and through, and this goes through slide 40 and then through 41, as you can see, they were just moving forward. And we're talking about a lot of soil and a lot of work on this property. Basically, from corner to corner, everything was dug out above the water table. Some of it we paid for, some of it we didn't. Now, slide 42. Basically, 2008, 2009. In the fall of 2009, the first main sections of the redevelopment property was completed. It's called the Duke, conveniently on Duke Street, and they've started selling some of the properties. In fact, in the last couple of weeks, I've been contacted by lawyers for some of the property owners who are buying these properties because of the information that was included in the contract from Van Meter Marquee Homes with regard to the previous use and everything, and the lawyers want to make sure that the homeowners weren't going to be buying into the liability. Slide 43, actions during the redevelopment. Basically, here's a summation of everything that we did on the property. We removed 28 USTs, over 35,000 tons of petroleum-impacted soil was removed. We recovered and disposed of an additional 1,000 gallons of free product that was identified during the excavation activities. We continued with the ongoing remediation off-site. That component that had migrated off-site to the adjacent property, we continued recovering out of there, and we hope to be finished very soon. And then we're, as I said, we're hoping to go into post-corrective action monitoring in the very near future. Slide 44, the responsible person, Fannin, continues to work under the corrective action plan. They continue to get paid out of our GovStuff, the petroleum funding that we have. The developer, Marquee Homes, Van Meter, they received one of those brownfield letters from us, a bona fide prospective purchaser, before they bought the property. So that helped with that was one of the requirements from their lending institution to get that letter prior to the purchase, the final purchase of the property, which occurred in May of 2008. And as I indicated, the condos and townhomes are available for occupancy for a very nice, close to $600,000, I think, for the townhomes right now. All right, slide 45. Okay, things in our favor. I think a lot of things in our favor for this particular site was that we have a, you know, basically a full-fledged petroleum program here in EPA in Virginia that's been signed off by the EPA. But our regulatory and technical programs are combined. So we do everything in pretty much in our office, as well as the money. So I can work with an RP, a consultant, not only with the technical program, the technical aspect of it, but the financial aspect as well. So there's a lot of, you know, coordination between the parties in our office. And since we're a local presence, you know, it really helps because we've established these, relationships. And also the fact is this is coastal plain geology here. So this really helped us because it was stream sediments and things like that. It wasn't hard rock fractures, which I'm sure anybody who's dealt with that makes remediation extremely difficult and much more costly than this particular one was. Slide 46, the other thing in our favor is the reality is we are in outside of Washington, D.C. Land value here is high, so there is an incentive for people to redevelop in our area. That's just the reality. There are parts of Virginia that are very poor, and that does not get a lot of redevelopment because, you know, a developer is going to say, well, why am I going to spend the extra money to do something that I can just build on a greenfield? We also had the involvement of the local government, obviously, to get buy-offs and approvals to do some of these things and to, you know, take the, you know, to be able to do something this large. We had the current things of, you know, the community meetings were very helpful to us because we got a feedback from everybody, and I think part of my experience is that if you at least let people know that you're here and that you're listening and that you're available and you're talking to them and tell them what's going on, that usually takes care of the problems, and we've had very few complaints from the local homeowners. We have an educated population, which is sometimes good, sometimes bad, because sometimes a little information is too much information. We have a lot of examples of successful redevelopment in our area where we're able to talk to people about, look, we've done it here, we've done it there, look, it was fine, you could talk to us about those, and we haven't really had any problems with them. And again, because we had the Brownfields program here on the state, we were able to offer those letters of comfort and some of those other things to people to do this. My observations and recommendations, 47. I strongly promote personal involvement. You really got to put some skin in the game if you want this to work. You really have to be willing to talk to these people and to spend the time to explain it to them, because I really think that that helps, especially something that's as complicated and as large as this one. There's a lot of hand-holding and sometimes neck-wringing, because sometimes you just have to get very frustrated. You have to be able to negotiate or stand firm on things, and you have to look at the big picture. I think that's probably one of the biggest, I think, we sometimes just want to see what happens tomorrow, but we're not willing to look at, you know, what's going to happen, you know, a few years down the road. And if you stood on that corner in 2001 and looked at that facility, you were just like, ugh. But now it is so much nicer. It is so much better. You're hard-pressed to even think that there was a terminal there. And you have to recognize, I think I had to recognize that there were a lot of changes that were just come out of left field and I have no control over, like the economy, or because there are so many players involved in this particular project, the things you just can't control. 48. Last one, I think that was it. So, questions, comments, I guess we'll wait until the end or do it now.
No, we can do a Q&A session here. If there's anybody that has any comments or questions for Randy, do that now. And also we'll have another Q&A session after Dan speaks here, City. I don't have anything from online yet. Is there anybody on the phone who has a question for Randy?
I have a question. This is Queenie Munjan Davis. I'm with Alps. And I just wondered, did you have any difficulty establishing that there's no dissolved plume that may have wandered off the site moving with groundwater flow?
Well, that was one of the advantages of the MIP survey, to determine what the groundwater component was, what the dissolved component was. And also, I've got several boxes of data from 82 on of all the monitoring wells that we had installed off the site and on some of the properties where we could get access. And so we had the MIP survey kind of confirmed where the dissolved was and where it wasn't. And again, because we're a risk-based program, the presence of the dissolve isn't a mandate that it has to be cleaned up. But by looking at it and then evaluating the risk, the depth of water table, the, you know, structures, the buildings, and things like that, there is an offsite component. And that's one of the things that we make clear to everybody during these meetings. We're not going to clean up everything. But once that terminal is gone, once those tanks are gone, once that source is gone, the dissolve phase is going to degrade on its own, as it will, you know, anyplace else. And here's the picture. Here's the files. Here's where it is and where it isn't. So even with future developers who come in, they have a better idea of what they're going to run into. But, yeah, so there's a dissolve phase, and it's there. But risk-wise, it didn't present a risk.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
This is Rick Pepino with US EPA. I have a hard time understanding the risk-based part of your presentation. You're saying that there actually could be people living in there that could be at a site that, based upon the other sites throughout the state, might have, I guess, significant levels of contamination. My question really is, if you were to go back and drill a hole in one of the yards, little backyards of these townhomes there, what type of hit would you get? I mean, and what you're saying is, from your perspective, you're saying it's livable, but how does that compare to, say, EPA sites?
Well, we are a risk-based program signed off by you folks, and we look at, once we remove the source, and part of the negotiations with the developer was that this basement structure, there's a basement garage structure, over underneath the entire living structure.
Okay, so, and there was a cap. There was a cap that was placed under that, I assume, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So any of the new soil that was brought in afterwards has all been replaced. That's no original contaminated soil there.
It was from corner to corner. As I said, close to 36,000 tons of soil was removed.
Well, when you say it's risk-based then, so it still has a ranking on the state list, because it's not completely clean, right?
That's true.
Okay, where does it stand? Are the new residents that buy the homes aware of their ranking? It's still contaminated and that it has a ranking on the state list? Are they told that?
Yes, it was part of their Marquee Homes, which is a Van Meter company. They include in their documentation to the prospective homeowners the history and a copy of the letters that I've written to Van Meter with regard to the different interim caps and where they stand. And so, as I indicated, we've already been contacted by several lawyers from those homeowners wanting to know what the liability is and what the risk is. And, again, part of the corrective action plan that was developed in the early 2000s and updated during the redevelopment process was to address, you know, to do things that would address this risk. But one of the things was that there are no living structures down at the lower level. Everything is above a garage structure, and that garage was designed to be passively vented. Now it's going to be actively vented as a requirement, an additional requirement from the city of Alexandria, which they can talk about in a moment. But risk-wise, again, it satisfied our risk criteria in our program for petroleum. And I will tell you, like I said at the very beginning, Virginia's program is maybe totally different from a lot of other programs, and it's unique to how we do how we look at things. And, I mean, I can recognize where some people may feel uncomfortable, but that is...
No problem. I mean, you're saying that a risk analysis was done. In other words, it was determined how many parts per million would remain and how much chances of cancer from BTEX or hydrocarbons, you know, per million... people could be done, and you're saying that's been done, and that was the assurance that you gave to the developer and the new residents in a letter, you know, so that as far as you're concerned, you know, you're done.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Good. Now, that's just different than the federal program, but, you know, I understand the difference.
All right.
there any other questions over the phone for Randy? I guess you can keep in mind that that Dan from the City of Alexandria is still going to speak, and he might be able to answer some of the questions. We do have a few questions that did come over through the text. I think one of them Randy addressed a little bit. What was the approximate total cost for the investigation and the cleanup?
Our portion, the Virginia Petroleum Storage Tank Fund portion, the maximum amount that we're going to pay out is $3 million. Because there were three separate releases associated with, we identified three specific releases, two from the 1300 block, which was the old terminal. One release came from the neighboring 1200 block, which was the above ground storage tank terminal. And together they were combined to have a total of $3 million that we would pay for out of our pocket. And that includes soil disposal, all the work since 1982. We're not there yet. One of the things, my requirements was to have a big cushion, you know, so we could make sure that everything was covered at the end. I hope we don't spend all $3 million, but that's what we allocated for this particular site. It's, I know that the developer spent a lot more money on soil removal than we reimbursed him for, because as I indicated, we covered the cost for the grossly contaminated soil. There was a lot of additional soil that they had to get out just because it was a redevelopment project. And some of it did have, you know, some petroleum in it, but we didn't pay for that because that was just normal background, you know, just low level stuff.
Okay. Was there a specific type of petroleum stored at Fannin? Was it all kinds?
Diesel, kerosene, 30,000 gallon ethanol tank, which would be an interesting, thing to thought about, methanol, unleaded gasoline, leaded gasoline, you know, the whole fuel oil. It was a big fuel oil terminal. So every type of fuel was stored since 62 at that terminal.
Okay. We have a couple questions here about vapor intrusion, but let's hold off until Dan speaks because I know he's going to talk a little bit about it. I don't know if he's going to get too technical about it, but I know that that was one of the upgrades, part of it, part of the situation. There's a question here, going back to slide 24. Given the MIP survey, it appears to be completed in linear patterns. How were you able to interpret the boundaries of the plume? And this is referencing the bottom of the drawing of slide 24.
A lot of the stuff that's on that particular, we had a lot of, again, since 82, we were able to install just your traditional monitoring wells. So the MIP survey was done on a linear pattern, as you can see there, but also in those block areas, what isn't shown on that map are the monitoring well locations. So it was a combination of, okay, here's the monitoring well data for this particular well for 10 years, and it never had anything. And so that was kind of incorporated into the boundaries, and it made a lot of sense. So, I mean, there was certainly some kriging done when they modeled this, but that was one of the things that we liked. The information from in the model and the output from Columbia Technologies really jived with what the traditional dissolve phase analytical model, you know, information was from over the decades. So we had that high comfort level.
Okay. Well, why don't we move on to Dan's presentation, because I know that he's got a few slides, and he does get into some of the upgrades that the city wanted to get into. So, and a correction, I think that last question was actually not slide 24. It was directed, I think, at slide 34. Let's now move on to Dan's presentation. It starts on slide 49. Dan?
All right, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right, so this is slide 49. I just have a couple of slides here in the hopes of giving you an overview of the city's involvement, touch briefly on some of the benefits that the city hopes to realize because of the redevelopment, and touch briefly again on the community involvement that was such a vital part of the redevelopment. So why don't we go on to, let's see here, the next slide, slide 50. the city does have its own dedicated contaminated land program. However, it's tied directly to the development site plan process per the zoning ordinance. So basically, unless a site has come to the city for redevelopment, our local office would not be involved. Now, obviously, it was started based upon the age of the city and the number of sites that were continuously being redeveloped. So they started the program in the hopes of overseeing some of the contamination issues that were continually showing up. And the last bullet down there does say most of the requirements that the city has can be met straight from the state requirements, straight from whatever Randy required, for instance, on this side of the Fannin site. So it's not, very rarely is it anything additional than what the state's already required. So let's move on to slide 51. So for this is kind of the standard submission that the city would require for any redevelopment project prior to releasing the site plan, prior to releasing the construction drawings, and they could actually break ground. So in Fannin's case in particular, they submitted to the city a combination remediation work plan and qualitative risk assessment, and then separately a combination health and safety plan for the construction activities. So although the reports were prepared specifically to meet the city's conditions of approval for the redevelopment, the vast majority of the information was simply lifted out of the corrective action plan that was already prepared for the state. So now the information, obviously we have the standalone reports, but to make the information most readily available for the city personnel, the city inspectors that are on site, the other thing we ask the developer to do, the development team, is to summarize that information, put it on the construction drawings, so a summary of the contaminations that is there, the summary of the health and safety plan, and then basically that's it, just summary of the reports that were submitted, so it's on the plan, and the construction inspectors can just take the plans without having to take the individual reports and have the information available to them as they oversee the construction. So we've already talked a little bit about some of the enhancements that the city requested of the developer. Moving on to slide 52, and they're listed here on this slide. So when the plan came in for redevelopment, the city made some additional requirements based upon what was already required. So obviously there was a vapor barrier already there. We just asked that the vapor barrier be upgraded, basically the thickness of the poly, and I think the developer ultimately went even beyond that. Randy already mentioned that per the corrective action plan, there was going to be a passive subslab ventilation system. We just asked that it be turned into an active system, create some negative pressure, and get any potential vapors from beneath the slab up and out of there. So the developer did raise the final foundation level to avoid any potential groundwater interference or to hit any potential groundwater. As the city takes a very conservative approach, we did ask them to put in a system that could handle any contaminated groundwater that might have found its way into the perimeter foundation system. So we asked them to put in a secondary sump, a second garage sump, and then have that connected to a carbon filtration system that was installed, and you can see it in the background of this slide. So it's there. We don't anticipate it's going to be used, but trying to protect the future homeowners association, if for whatever reason, if there was a pocket of groundwater, if there was groundwater levels rose drastically, then there would be a system there that could handle any treatment of groundwater. And the last bullet point on this slide is the city does require, per the conditions of approval, the notification in the disclosure that the developer hands out to potential buyers. And in this case, it would mention the site history and then any ongoing remedial measures that are being taken at the site. And I think, as Randy said, that I've received two calls, and I think Randy's received a couple calls, and that's where the attorneys are pulling the information from. So if we move on to the next slide, slide 53, just a couple of pictures. The very complicated way to turn a passive system into an active system and actually add some fans to draw the pressure. A picture of the foundation and the upgraded vapor barrier in the middle of construction. Moving on to the next slide, a picture of the secondary sump as it was being installed. And then finally, a disclosure. The text is probably too small to read, but this is the actual verbiage that appears in the disclosure statement that is provided to the potential buyers. I don't think it's all of it. It's just a section. So if we move on to the next slide, which is slide 55, this slide basically just touches on some of the city's expected economic benefits. The numbers do differ a little bit from what Randy said, but these numbers were actually generated from the city's Office of Management and Budget. So at that point, they're estimating that the total value of the property post-construction, and they're nearly there, would be about $36 million. And once again, that is based on a mix of 58 units, townhomes and condominiums. So 58 units divided by $36 million, you can imagine what these places are worth on a per-unit basis. So based upon the real estate tax rate, the Office of Management and Budget estimated that the tax revenue generated from this site post-development would be about $320,000 for the city. Now, for a city that only has an annual budget of about $500 million, that is, it's not an insignificant amount of money. So it's, the city obviously is ecstatic about having this parcel redevelop. Now the $320,000 is annual tax revenue, but does not include the cost of services for the residential, redevelopment. So, the actual, I don't know what else to call it, it's not profit, but after the services are rendered, for the future residents, the actual dollar amount realized by the city is actually about half, so about $150,000-$160,000. Now that does double the tax revenue from the old development, which is fantastic. And just to remind everyone, none of those estimates include any attempt to increase, to adjust for the, surrounding property and how they would also realize some additional economic benefits. So that's just a brief summary of some of the economic benefits. So if we move on to the next slide, and this just touches on some of the community involvement and the benefits. So the site itself is zoned office commercial, but it does allow for residential, and it's been included in the city small area plan long before the redevelopment came in as targeted for redevelopment. Because as Randy said, this was one of the last industrial parcels along Duke Street in this immediate area that was waiting to transition away from that, with the brownfield being one of the major hurdles. So once again, the neighborhood surrounding it is heavily residential, which was what was envisioned by the small area plan. So the project fit really nicely into the character envisioned by both the city council and which was ultimately getting back to what the community wanted. So as part of the development process and outside of just the standard meetings that would occur due to redevelopment, as Randy said, there was individual stakeholder group meetings with the adjacent homeowners association, with the single family residences, and then the abutting church that played a key role in allowing the relocation of the existing groundwater and soil vapor extraction system that's being operated under the state's corrective action plan to continue to operate during construction. So, and then the last point, the other group that had exposure to this was the Board of Architectural Review for the city, because the front half of the site is located in the city's historic, quote, historic district, even though looking at it, you wouldn't think it was, but based upon the designation, the delineation of the area, it was included, and then it got to be, we got additional exposure in front of that group as well. So they were, during the redevelopment, the community obviously was very positive about the redevelopment. The only negative comments were all based upon traditional redevelopment concerns, traffic, parking, open space, and those were all addressed through working with the developer and through the development process. So the other thing that is worthy to note is the cooperation of the adjacent Baptist church because of the relocation of the remedial system during construction. So I know my presentation wasn't very long, but that's essentially it. If there's specific questions about the city's involvement, I would be more than happy to answer them now, or you can send them in via email.
Thanks, Dan. And Dan's contact information is on slide 57.
57.
And I hope that answers some of the questions about vapor intrusion, but I didn't know, Randy or Dan, if you knew anything more about the vapor intrusion assessment, or, because we do have a question here and asked what was a vapor intrusion assessment performed as part of the risk assessment, and they probably want to know, I don't know if we have any details about that other than some of the systems that we talked about that were installed.
I mean, that was part of the corrective action plan development that they had to look at, that as potential. And again, in incorporating, sitting down with the developer and saying, listen, if you do, this is how we can solve this problem. And again, moving the property well above the water table, the historic water table rise, having a garage between any of the units and the properties, you know, and the water table there. So all those things were looked at as so that when we walked away, that the risk issues were addressed. Could we do it differently today? Absolutely. We're probably looking at certainly things that have changed in the last 10 years with regard to some of the indoor air analysis in residential properties, which is a couple other project I'm working on now, and our office has seen more interest of it, and Curve Laboratories with EPA is working on it. But at that time, I mean, we feel that everything was addressed and everything fits what we know about the site. And, yeah, we're comfortable, and as Dan indicated, they even increased it by having an active as opposed to the passive that we had as part of the corrective action plan.
Right. I think the city took a practical belt suspenders approach where you had the vapor barrier, then you had below the vapor barrier, obviously, you had the active system. And then you also have the garage system just for automobile exhaust that also is moving the vapors from automobiles out of the garage. So there's really three systems in place now that would mitigate any potential vapor issues.
Okay, the second part of that is someone asked about, can you tell us a little more about the vapor abatement system with respect to any elevator shafts, if there were any, how they might have been addressed? I know that's always an issue, is how you deal with those elevator shafts in larger buildings.
I don't believe there's any, and we're talking about townhomes. Now, over in the condo area, I'd have to ask Dan about that, but that wasn't a
consideration.
No.
Okay.
Well, I think there is. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't think they're using a below, the type of shaft, the system that they're using doesn't exceed below the groundwater.
No, that's my understanding as well.
Yeah.
My understanding is there is one elevator shaft in the condominium building, and that I guess that was part of the reason we tried to put the, some of the fans adjacent to the elevator shaft and draw any potential vapors away from there. But as far as I know, and this ultimately may be a code question for the city in regards to if there's any other additional requirements that I'm not familiar with, but I think that was the only thing that was that I'm aware of that was done.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Question about the MIP. Were there any issues with MIP saturation due to free product in the subsurface?
Yeah, that was one of the surprises that we hit along Duke Street, that other component of the plume that came from, it was on the right side of the screen there. We were going along, and based upon the historic information, we thought we were going to be in a pretty clean zone. And, I mean, it pegged. It blew the GC, and we had to wait a while to clean it out and to get it recalibrated. But it was a surprise. We didn't expect to hit the saturated free product area, or free saturated soil area that we did. And again, we put in more MIP points as part of that whole triad philosophy of making the soil changes. We put the MIP points a little bit closer together so that we would kind of had defined that offsite component. And again, yeah, I mean, we addressed that. The other areas of the property, we kind of already had an idea that we would run into product in certain areas, and as a result, we were kind of prepared for it to have the detection limit not set so low and how fast we drove the MIPS probe into the ground. But yeah, we had to account for it, and as I said, that one area was a surprise to us.
Okay. We have another a question here, I think, related to vapor intrusion, and this is always kind of a sticky question, especially with the traffic along Duke Street. But this question is about in indoor air, if it was considered as part of the vapor intrusion planning, and if any indoor air sampling has been performed since the condos were built, and if there are any results from those, if it was done.
We're not going to require any, certainly from the DEQ. Indoor air is obviously a sticky issue and is fraught with problems because of all of the other contaminants that may be in a structure, particularly a brand new structure. I wouldn't even want to go down that pathway, but I can tell you from the state's point of view, from the state's, my office, we certainly haven't required or requested. And again, part of the corrective action was that when we walked away from that site, we were done with that site. It was addressed. And, you know, if there's any additional stuff, that would be, I guess, you know, Dan could answer that if they're going to require any.
No, I think that was the city was comfortable with that based upon the enhancements that we requested.
Okay. And then we have a question here that's, I think, more sort of urban planning and redevelopment. Was affordable housing ever considered as part of the project mix? Or is that required by Alexandria?
I wasn't here for the approval itself. The city does have an affordable housing requirement that is typically required for developers. Of course, it's all based upon the dollars needed to redevelop the site. And based upon this having 58 units and the amount of money it took the developer to get rid of the brownfields, I can verify, but I think that the affordable housing requirement from the city was not enforced for Fannin, for the Duke on this project.
Okay. Well, I know that's all the questions I have that have come in through the text to me. Do we have any other questions from the participants on the phone lines? Any more questions from the participants on the phone lines? Remember, you have to hit #6 to unmute your phone if you've chosen to mute your phone that way. Well, if there are no more questions, I'd like to thank both of our speakers today for a very interesting and enlightening presentation. And thank you to all of our participants through Clue-In. We appreciate your attending our seminar. Thanks, everybody.